Welcome to the Bad Apples, episode 10, season 2. This is the big final scale roundup, mainly because I'm back from scale now, and I can kind of sit down and think it over and try to remember something about it and maybe discuss it a little bit here. I also have some new interviews to play for you. Okay, so let's just jump into some of the interviews first. The first interview I have is with two representatives from the Foresight Linux project. And Foresight I had heard vaguely of because of an interview that someone had done on the Linux Link Tech Show with the Linux Link Tech Show guys. So I'd heard of the project. I didn't know a whole lot about it. I didn't really have any clear memory of what was said on that interview, so... And I actually haven't gone back and listened to that episode yet again, so for all I know, this interview covers a lot of the same ground. But anyway, this I found speaking to them just immensely interesting, and so let's listen.
Okay, so I'm at Scale. I am at the Foresight Linux booth with Ken Van Dyne, was my guess.
You're almost right.
And Kevin Harris. That's an easy one.
Yep.
So Foresight is a distro claiming that your desktop should look freaking cool.
That's right. Freaking cool.
Freaking cool. Okay, so I was talking to Kevin about Foresight a little bit earlier, and he was saying that the idea is it's all bleeding edge stuff, right? It's got all the latest packages of pretty much everything.
Right, so some of the stuff we've really focused on is desktop integration and making as many things as possible just work. The Linux desktop is evolving very, very quickly. And if you work on a six-month release cycle or a one-year release cycle and you're not getting new stuff out there, there's so much stuff you're leaving in the dust. There's so many benefits from staying current. So when we say bleeding edge, we don't mean unstable. We mean integrating the latest stuff that makes the desktop better as quickly as we can. An example is what we used to call Project Utopia, HAL, the hardware abstraction layer, UDEV, which we use for device detection stuff. Those sorts of things were, and Dbus, weren't well integrated into distros 3 years ago when I created Foresight. None of the distros out there were shipping all of them yet.
Okay.
And I created Foresight, and first thing we did was incorporate all this Project Utopia stuff to really make things just work well together. And other distros were still struggling trying to get that put together. But I really felt it was important to get that kind of stuff out there.
The other thing is not just bleeding edge update, like current stable editions of the mainstream software, but a lot of smaller applications that not a lot of people have heard of before. Like Conduit, for instance, the Conduit developers came to us and wanted us, because we had it packaged, and they were asking, what can we do to get it in your mainstream stable release? And we gave them a checklist of things we would like done before, and we gave it to them, and they worked on it, and then when they got it done, we included it. And the same thing with GNOME. If we see an application that we see is greatly improves the usability of the desktop, we include it in our distribution. So GNOME is included in our alpha release right now, and it's packaged in our repositories for our FL1, our stable edition.
Okay, so you guys, I'm kind of getting that you're GNOME-centric, maybe? Or
historically, we have been. Originally, Foresight was kind of evolved from something that happened when I was involved with GNOME marketing. I'm still involved with GNOME marketing, but I had a lot of frustrations that we would release new versions of GNOME with new features. We would document new features and release notes and things like that, but people couldn't really consume it yet for
a
month, 6 months, whatever, until their distros provided it, unless they built it all from source. And who wants to build all of GNOME from source? Nobody. And so there'd be all this hype about new features in GNOME on /.dot, whatever, and by the time all that hype had settled down, distros had it available to the users, and the users didn't care anymore. It was very frustrating to me as a GNOME marketer. So one of the reasons why I created Foresight was to really get the latest GNOME out there quickly so people could use it right away. So from the time we created it, we've had Foresight releases along with GNOME releases on GNOME release day. The tools we use to build the distro are so dynamic, so powerful, that we can easily build this stuff and test it very quickly and actually have releases with those bits on them on GNOME release day, which is why we are now the base for the GNOME live demos available on GNOME.org. There's VMware images, hard disk images, live CD, all that kind of stuff. That's all built based on Foresight, and I build those.
But Foresight Linux 2, which is our current, our next major release of Foresight Linux, is going to have a KDE edition and an XFC edition, which adhere to the same philosophies that our current GNOME edition does. So you'll be able to get those same key KDE app desktop applications and an improved usability for all KDE users, XFC users. And just yesterday, they released the FL2 Alpha KDE ISOs. So people could go try out the FL2 ISOs, which it's called Alpha and Beta now, but the main reason is because a lot of our apps from FL1 aren't completely ported over. It's not that it's not stable and you can't run it. We both run it on our desktops and our daily work machines, and it's stable. It just doesn't have all the applications, but all the key applications are there.
So the key point there is, not only is the desktop evolving very quickly, but we're evolving as a distro. I mean, my passion is really with GNOME. I'm still heavily involved with GNOME, but our community's grown, and we've got community members that have cared enough to create other editions that follow the same trend and create other editions that cater to other users, and we're thrilled about that.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. So it's not just the most eye candy. It's just like the most up-to-date, basically, and you do a rolling release so that when something new comes out, you roll it into the distro, and they just do an upgrade or what?
Right. So, as we do incremental upgrades, we don't have a release cycle of like every 6 months there's going to be a major release. So some bugs, you don't really see the fix for 6 months like you do in some other distros. We are constantly fixing stuff, updating new versions. We're committing them to the repository, and you're really just following our repository as you're doing updates. When we have what we call releases, is really a snapshot of what we've defined as the distro from the current tip of the repository. As same thing as any user who's been running Foresight for years, just doing an update of their system would get. So there's never a reason to re-download the ISOs and do a fresh install. Just keep updating. There's no major transition from version to version to version. It's just from time to time we put a number on it and say it's a release.
And the major reason we do that is because we'll see, there's 100 or so updates after a fresh install. So we're like, we don't want our users to have to do 100 updates. We'll just spin new ISOs. That way new users download it and they only have a few updates to do.
Right. And so the package manager, I understand, is either your own or you've got some sort of distinct packaging going on?
Right. It's Canary is the name of the package manager. It's created by the company named RPath, which I happen to work for, but I created Foresight actually quite a while before I went to work at RPath. But I love the tool so much, I eventually went and worked there. The tools are really designed for creating derivative distros or the really software appliances, is what RPath's business model is really all about. Foresight was the first derivative distro created with those tools. We've since pretty much became the upstream for the graphical type desktop appliance based on those tools. Canary is a very, very robust package manager. It's got really strong dependency information. We also is transactional, so updates can be rolled back, which is very, very interesting. So if you apply an update, something doesn't go well, you do a rollback, you're back to a known good state, and it merges back your local changes through time as you do rollbacks. So it keeps that.
That sounds really, really distinct or unique, I guess. Is there anything else like that, or that's...
Nothing else. So the guys who created Canary, Eric Trone, Matt Wilson, and Michael Johnson, they're all former Red Hat guys. Eric Trone actually wrote RPM originally. When they left Red Hat, they sat down and they spent a lot of time looking at all the other solutions that were out there and figured out what they all did well and what they didn't do well and figured out how they can create the tool that could do what they want to do. I mean, it's all about deriving and making everything play well together. Some people say it's making the Linux market too fragmented, but it's really bringing it together because they're all, there's more relationship. So it's just, you can call them mashups. Like Google mashups are really popular right now. You can literally create your own distro based on Foresight where you pick various packages that you want to include in your own version of it and just click a few buttons in a web browser and have your own version. Very cool.
All right, so what if I don't want Foresight? I want Canary on my Slackware distro.
Probably not a good idea. Package managers like to own the system. So Canary really needs to know it owns the files on your system, and if something else slobbers it, things don't go well. Another thing that's cool about that, though, is that it knows so much about the packages and the files that are installed on your system, you can actually do a verify on packages and see what's been modified, which is also very, very handy. You can do a verify of the entire system to find every file that's been modified on your system. One really great use case for that, we found recently one of our engineers at RPath, we all run Foresight there, and he's been running XFS as his file system forever. And all of a sudden, his GNOME desktop started behaving weird, and programs were crashing, and funky stuff was happening, and he couldn't figure out why. So he did a canary verify of his system, and he found he had a ton of packages that had corruptions in their shared libraries. There were truncated files that happened during an update. And so Canary Verify showed that, and he did some Googling and found that, you know, like three releases of the kernel had a horked XFS implementation, which actually we found it on an Ubuntu forum. They were affected by it, too. Anybody who's running XFS had this problem where files getting ripped to disk got truncated. Not cool for shared libraries. But then he was able to use Canary to actually repair those files very easily and get himself back to a running system, which was pretty handy.
So Foresight, is it based on like Debian or Fedora, or is it LFS or what?
None of the above. It's essentially a top-level distro now. Originally, it was created as a derivative of RPath Linux, which, if you look at the various maps that people have created of all the, you know, the relationships to distros, people fork it off of Fedora. It's really not, but Michael Johnson was the first leader of Fedora. He works at RPath. He was originally the guy behind our distro at RPath. They imported everything so it was really compatible with Fedora. We use the same init scripts and that sort of stuff, you know, System 5 init, and we're very compatible with Red Hat. But it started from scratch there. It wasn't really forking from Fedora. But we're most compatible with that, so people relate us most closely with that. But since then, RPath is, you know, their business has always been appliances, not the desktop. So they've actually stripped out all the desktop stuff from their operating system, and we're the base for that now. So we have no parent for all the desktop-related stuff. So probably 15 or 20% of our distro comes from RPath Linux, and they maintain that, some of the core OS bits, and everything above that stack, Foresight maintains at the top level. And there are some derivatives of Foresight. People are making their own mashups and stuff like that, and we encourage other derivatives to build on that. And we've designed Foresight, actually. The coming up release of Foresight 2 has been designed very much to make it very easily consumed for derivatives. I created a derived, rebranded version of Foresight just last week in 1 hour's worth of work, completely rebranded, no Foresight name anywhere. Very handy.
Now, actually, I was looking at one of the demos, and it doesn't look like you do that much branding on it. I mean, the GNOME footprint was still on the GNOME menu, things like that. Do you actually brand that much? It doesn't seem like you do.
We try not to. The splash themes we have, things like that, say Foresight Linux, but we try to stay true to GNOME, because I'm a GNOME guy. I love GNOME. I do not want to replace that GNOME foot, because we're shipping GNOME, and we try to stay as close to upstream as we can. And of course, anything we patch, we send the patches upstream and, you know, try to play well with upstream. But again, we don't want to take away the brand recognition that GNOME has.
That and the other issue with us staying as true to form as we can, some say vanilla GNOME, is any bugs that our users find can be applied upstream to GNOME, and any translations that our users do, because we have a lot of international users that will do translation, and then we apply those upstream as well. That way the whole community can benefit from the whole. Whereas some other distributions that like move menu options around in GNOME, you can't really submit your translations upstream because they don't apply anywhere. So it's almost like wasted work in a sense, because the whole community is not benefiting. It's just the small subsect of the community.
Translations and documentation.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's kind of a problem I've noticed. I mean, people go online for help, and the screenshots look different, and that turns a lot of users, like, totally off.
Right. One of my goals would be if they're familiar with using GNOME, they can go to any distro and sit down and use it and be comfortable and know how to do things. And that's unfortunately not completely true with all distros.
Yeah. So you're always doing cutting-edge releases. Does this mean that the KDE version is going to be KDE 4?
Of course.
What else?
Very cool.
Currently, the ISO is the latest KDE 3.5, and that's just because...
It's four.
They were telling me...
It's so cutting edge that you guys don't even know what it is.
Let me get a little correction. I don't know if it's actually released. It was being tested yesterday.
Okay.
I've been here, so I don't really know what the status is, but it was being tested.
Fair enough. I don't know. It sounds like a really exciting project. I get the sense from talking to you guys, the same kind of feeling I get from talking to the Fedora guys, where it's like, we're going to throw this in, and it'll work, and that's going to be the thing, you know, and it doesn't have to be, like, tried and true, you know. You can just, like, give it a go, and kind of exciting. Where can we find you? Foresight Linux dot, I don't know, what is
dot
it?
.org. .com.net, all of them, you know.
ForesightLinux.org. Cool. Yeah.
We also have a very welcoming community. We'd love to have new contributors join us on Pound Foresight on Freenode. We'd love to talk to folks.
fantastic. Thanks a lot for talking to me, Ken and Kevin.
It was a great time.
So that was the Foresight Linux guys, and after I spoke with them, I noticed that not too far away from their booth was a very sort of barren, minimalistic booth, which happened to belong to what else but Fluxbox. So I got a chance to speak to one of the developers from Fluxbox, which is a great little window manager, as you probably know. You may use it, you might not have used it yet, but you might have heard of it. But is really good little window manager. Fits a certain style of workflow really, really well. So give a listen to this interview.
I am at Scale, standing with Mark at the Fluxbox booth. And he's showing off the latest version of Fluxbox, which is Fluxbox 1.0 right now, right?
Right.
And so Fluxbox is sort of a lightweight, window manager technically, right?
Yeah, it's actually a heavy window manager, but it usually gets compared to GNOME or KDE, which are desktop environments, and it's way smaller than those.
Okay, cool. And I was noticing, I've used Fluxbox before, but I guess I'm not a power Fluxbox user, but I was noticing on your demo that there's a lot of transparency and things like that kind of built in, I guess.
That's actually handled by a program called XComp MGR. We just tell it how transparent each window should be, and it does the rendering for us.
Cool. And what exactly are you the lead developer right now on Fluxbox? Or a lead developer?
Right, yeah.
Okay, cool.
I've been doing a lot of the development for the past couple of years.
Okay, cool. How many of you are there?
There are five of us who do the main contributions, but of course we get patches from everywhere.
Yeah, of course. And are you all, where are you guys based? Are you guys like spread over the world pretty much?
Yeah, we're based in an IRC channel.
Right, yeah, cool. And I assume that's on Freenode at hash Fluxbox?
Yeah, right.
Cool, okay. And who do you find, who do you perceive your audience to be? Like who uses Fluxbox, do you think?
A major portion of our users are people running it on older hardware. That's a comment I've been getting from a lot of people at this conference.
Right.
And also, I think people who are, you know, more advanced, they like to use the keyboard for everything, don't want to have to deal with, you know, dialog boxes to configure everything on their system.
Okay.
Just use the terminal a lot.
Right, right. So it's basically a good graphic interface where you're really living in the terminal a lot, but you need, or you might need, like, to open up something graphically. So it's just like bare bones graphic interface.
Exactly.
Very cool. Thanks a lot, Mark, and we'll be sure to check Fluxbox out. Thanks.
All right, thanks.
As I said in the interview, Fluxbox really does seem to fit a certain style of workflow, really like it fits like a glove, you know, and that workflow is you're in the terminal a lot, and you don't want to just have an entirely text-based interface because you need to see, for instance, pictures, JPEGs, movies, or something like that. But you also don't necessarily want to have to, you know, you don't need the other desktop kind of conventions like a trash can or little folder icons here and there and a hard drive icon, things like, or file system icon, little drop-down menus, because you're not necessarily going to use those kinds of things. You're going to either launch things via the terminal, or if you need it, you can click somewhere and get it. So on Fluxbox, that's what it is. It's basically a blank screen. You bring up a terminal, you do your work. You need to see a picture. You can go into the folder via the terminal and just launch whatever picture you need in whatever picture viewer you have. Or if you want to do it a different way, you can right click on the desktop area, on the empty desktop area, and a little pop-up menu comes up. And of course, the pop-up menu you can configure entirely to your liking. You can divide it into whatever kind of categories you want. It's a very simple little configuration file that you type into and just change the menus. The first time I did it, I just did it, you know, because it does an auto configuration, and just looking at the auto configured menu, you can pretty much do it yourself. It's really simple stuff. So it's a really cool little desktop manager, window manager. It does not have, for instance, a file manager, a proper file manager like Conqueror or Thunar or Nautilus or whatever you're used to. So it's something that you can add those file managers to, or you can simply do your file management via the terminal, which I think I get the feeling that is the more common method of doing it. So it's a neat desktop environment, and if you find yourself kind of playing around in the terminal a lot more than you do playing around, you know, moving files around with little icons, then you might want to check Fluxbox out. Sounds like it's time for a cup of coffee. Why don't you go make yourself one, and we will come back and listen to another interview together with coffee.
All right, do you have some questions?
I do have questions. I caught up with the Foresight people again. They're hard to get to because apparently Foresight is like the talk of scale. You guys were talking a little bit earlier about RPM and like its history. And, you know, all I hear, I've got Fedora on an iBook that I installed at the beginning of the show, the first episode. So one of the things I hear a lot is how RPMs really, really just don't work, I guess. And so is that right? I mean, I haven't actually had that much trouble, and when I do have trouble, I just compile it from source. So, yeah. What's up?
Okay, so a little bit of the history of RPM. My boss, Eric Trone, he's the creator of Canary, but he also created RPM way back in the day, early Red Hat days.
And Canary is the package manager in Foresight that's
right.
Totally crazy.
That's right. It's totally crazy rocks. Everybody should use Canary. However, he did design and create RPM back in the early days of Red Hat, and, you know, when I first met Eric, first thing I told him is RPM sucks. And he said, But it does what it was designed to do. RPM was originally designed with the notion of every update in every package is going to be installed from a CD, not over the web. And that was the requirements. And RPM was probably great at that because all dependencies were always satisfied on that CD. And they didn't have all these things that wrap around that stuff and fetch files from various places on the web that may or may not be depth complete between the two of them. It might not actually satisfy those dependencies, which is where you get into, you know, what everybody's affectionately calls RPM hell. RPM hell or dependency hell, because you can abstract it out to, you know, make it more general because everybody has dependency hell. Canary makes dependency hell very, very manageable, so it doesn't hurt. But other systems have that sort of problem as well. But it was the same thing with dpackage, which apt is a front end for. Dpackage was created the same sort of way, where everything's going to be installed from a file. You download files from the web and you install them. Or maybe you get them off the CD. I'm not sure how Debian used to package their stuff way back then. However, apt's been around longer than yum. But they're really just front ends that go and fetch stuff. They have some meta information about the packages and installs them all on your system or provides updates. Those packaging tools weren't designed to do that from the get-go. So there's some limitations by the original design, and they've improved a lot. They've come a long, long ways. But Canary was created from the ground up with this concept of network repositories, and the repositories actually talk to each other to create change sets that apply things down to your system. So if you install a package from repository A that was originally shadowed from repository B, it actually doesn't contain all those files. The two repositories together compute that change set that gets applied to your system. So it's this whole mesh network kind of thing, or I don't know if mesh network's the right word for it, but a whole network that has a relationship that together gives you the change set you need to update your system.
So if there's a third world war, big apocalypse, the internet goes down, and the world is divided into Linux-using tribes, what do we do? Because there's no internet. I mean, are we going to survive getting new software, or how's that going to work?
Well, it is possible to extract all the information from packages out of repositories into change set files that can be installed on systems. Canary was really not designed to do that. However, you can actually create a change set out of a repository and then carry it over to a machine on a CD and put it into a CD and install that change set. It's not a dynamic change set anymore, a relative change set. It's actually what we call an absolute change set, that it has all the bits necessary for that package to be there on the change set, as opposed to just the computed differences between your local system and the repository. So it is possible to create those. We actually do have customers, RPath does, that has dark site requirements. So they need to be able to update appliances in a dark site that doesn't have internet connectivity. So you can create what we call an update CD in RBuilder. RBuilder Online is the tool we use to create distros and appliances. Foresight is created with RBuilder Online as well. But there's an option in there when you can create installable ISOs and all these virtual machine image types. You can also create an update ISO. And what an update ISO is contains a bunch of absolute change sets that make up the appliance. And then you can put in this DVD or a CD that's built from this ISO into one of these appliances, or even Foresight, for example, and actually be able to update from that as well, using the Canary command line. Or on appliances, we have the RPath Appliance Platform Agent, which is a web-based tool for managing the appliances, applying updates, and things like that. It has an interface to actually apply updates from a DVD versus just from the web.
Gotcha. Very cool. And so you were saying, too, that you guys have, I guess, personal, sort of personal repositories?
Yes. So RBuilder Online, like I mentioned a minute ago, it's free for anybody to use. Anybody can create an account on there. When you can create an account and you can create a project. And RBuilder's been doing this for several years now, but I'll compare it to the new PPAs, the personal archive. Now that might be it. That Launchpad provides in the Ubuntu world, where you can create your own repositories in Launchpad. That's a relatively new feature in Launchpad. RBuilder's been doing that for years. So you can go and you create a username and create an account on RBuilder, then you can go create your own project, and you can actually commit your own packages to that repository. You can do a number of things with that. You can just say you're a Foresight user and you want to create your own packages, or maybe you want to make changes to existing Foresight packages, so you shadow packages. I won't explain shadowing right now, but you can apply patches to these things yourself and maintain different versions of packages in your own repository. And you can go as far as actually creating your own installable ISOs. So you can have a system, say you want to derive Foresight Linux and remove all the games from it and remove the media stuff and have like a business edition. You can easily remove those sorts of things, click a little button in RBuilder and create installable ISOs, and then go deploy those throughout your business and install them on all the machines. And then you have your own derived version of Foresight.
Now, that's really cool. So if you derive your own version, you could, in theory, have like your sort of your master copy of the OS, so that when you just drop it in, you install it, it's got everything. Now, from that point, can you just update to the latest versions of the packages via like the online repos?
Right. Sort of. You would actually, then you would become basically the maintainer of your own distro. And you would have to make a conscious effort to cook your own groups, is the metaphor we use. We have this concept of a group that defines what goes into the distro, or goes into the appliance in the appliance case. And there's a process we call cooking that goes through this manifest of all the things that's going to be included in that, and creates a binary package that contains just a list of packages with the exact versions that are going to be included in that update. So until you cook those groups, the users won't see updates. So then the release management burden goes on you as the distro maintainer, which is good because maybe you haven't tested them on your hardware and you want to make sure that it's going to work. So you test it on your own machines and then you build it and give it out to your users. But the burden of that is very, very low. It's a really, really simple process to do, and it gives you some level of control.
So this is kind of, I mean, it seems like Foresight is kind of really about the user. That almost seems to me like it would be kind of ideal for maybe a new Linux user who needs kind of something that they can easily kind of control and customize for themselves.
Right. So we very much try to target ourselves at the new user. We want the user experience to be first and foremost. We have a goal. Everything should just work. We don't want you twiddling configs and things like that to try to make your iPod work and things like that. We want to make everything just work right out of the box for the new user and not be intimidating. On the flip side, we're also very friendly to developers because you have a lot of power with the tools to be able to extend it yourself and do other things. The user experience is top on our list.
Very cool. Yeah, it sounds great. I'm going to definitely check it out. Maybe, I don't know, I do a new wallpaper, a desktop art every week for my show. Maybe, who knows, with any luck, it'll be a Foresight wallpaper this time. So we can find you at foresight.org.
Foresightlinux.org.
Foresightlinux.org. And on the IRC at #Foresight.
On Freenode.
On Freenode. Cool, thanks.
So that's all the interviews I've got. I'm probably just going to talk a little bit about Scale itself. So if you're not into hearing about expos, or you went to Scale and you don't need to hear about it, this is probably the end of the podcast for you. For everyone else, Scale was a really, really great event, as great in retrospect as it was, you know, in the moment. On Friday, it was the a sort of kind of a niche group of talks, medical, open source medical stuff, women in open source. The Friday talks, certainly in the women in open source track, was actually, some of them were really good, and not really about women in open source. A lot of them were just happened to be women in open source, but they were talking about other topics as well. I could be wrong, but I think that a talk about Drupal that I really enjoyed and attended, I'm pretty sure that was on Friday, in the Women in Open Source track, and that was certainly an informative and dynamic kind of presentation. Really got me excited about Drupal. Now I finally understand what Chad over at the Linux Basement is always talking about. You know, I've always kind of gotten through his Drupal tutorials with sort of a mystification and confusion, not really understanding. Now I think I'll go back and listen to them, because I'm probably going to be playing around with Drupal. There was also the Scale University courses on Friday, so there were two of those. There was one on fighting spam on your email system, and there was another on virtualization. I attended the first one. It was a 4-hour class or a 3-hour class. Very comprehensive, very informative. It was all about fighting spam on the server side of things. Not so much on the end user, but on the system administrator trying to prevent spam from getting through to the end users. So that was really, really informative, well presented, and a lot of fun. Saturday was the Scale grand opening, I guess. That's when really everyone arrived. It really picked up on Saturday, because that was when it was more the general. That's when the booths opened and things like that. So the booths, I guess, as I've mentioned, there was the Foresight Linux, there was the Ubuntu booth, obviously, which I mentioned in a previous episode. There was the Debian booth right behind the Ubuntu booth, actually, or in front of the Ubuntu booth, I guess it depends on how you're looking at it. And those guys were really informative and cool. Debian developers just kind of sitting around playing on computers. Right near the Debian booth, right across and a little bit to the right of them, was the KDE booth, and I spoke to them with a great deal of excitement, of course, and they were running both 3.5 point whatever and 4.0.1, so that was neat to see the big KDE 4, you know, on display, and it was holding up quite well. And I should probably mention, or I think I might have already mentioned, that on my presentation, I was running, you know, I plugged my laptop into the projector. This is my Sony VAIO laptop, and it's running KDE 4, and everything not only worked, but it just performed really, really well, and it was a nice experience and a nice chance to kind of show off KDE 4 in a real-life example, because people, I think, were seeing me use KDE 4. A lot of them were just wondering what on earth it was, and I had to tell them, this is it, this is KDE 4. And not only, you know, is it functional, but, I mean, it's functional enough, it works well enough that I use it all the time, and I'm using it, you know, in a live situation, you know, production environment, like a live talk. So that was really cool, and I was doing a lot of, it was kind of a mild multimedia presentation. You know, I had pictures and video and present and slides and things like that. So that was really cool to see that kind of come together nicely and work really well. So that was fun. Near KDE 4, the No Starch Press guys were there with all their different books on all kinds of different Linux topics. That was cool. There was a little hardware manufacturing company called Zareason, Z-A-R-E-A-S-O-N. They install Ubuntu and maybe other distros, I don't know. They were demoing Ubuntu on some laptops, and there were some really nice laptops there. There was the sort of the middle range, I think it was called the Lab, L-A-B, I think, and it was a sturdy little laptop. Probably, I mean, if I were in the market right now to buy a laptop, I'd probably have picked that up. It was only about $900 or $1,000, and it was just a sturdy, solid laptop. I was really impressed with that one. Across from them, or near them anyway, were Red Hat and Fedora. So Fedora, of course, love the Fedora project, very exciting. Cutting edge kind of stuff is always fun because it's just, you never know what they're going to do next. So I was really excited about getting to talk to Tom Calloway, which I interviewed in the previous episode. And, you know, it's a cool distribution. Next to them were Red Hat. And I know Red Hat's slightly, mildly controversial because they are getting basically improvements from a big developer community, and they're then turning around and selling an OS based on these improvements that were developed by people who aren't getting paid. My perception of this, and it could be naive, is that Red Hat serves a certain function in the market of Linux because it not only distributes Linux to people who, you know, businesses who feel that they need to pay for their operating system, but also that they are employing a lot of Linux developers and a lot of Linux users. Whether you're actually working at Red Hat proper or you're working at a business that is running Red Hat, at least you're getting to use Linux, you're getting to develop it, you're getting a paycheck, and that's kind of cool. And Red Hat, I just see as a very, they've been a very resistant towards any kind of Microsoft deal. I mean, they haven't made any Microsoft deals, so they've been a stalwart against that. They've supported OGG continually and strongly. So I'm just, I don't know, I don't have a problem with Red Hat, and certainly don't have a problem with Fedora. Fluxbox and GNOME was there, and Foresight was there. A couple of the BSDs were there, some server companies, a couple of different open source programs that were multi-platform were also there. So although you did see a couple of non-Linux running, you know, computers not running Linux, it was down to the bare minimum, which was great, and it did serve a function. I kind of sneered at this at first, but as I was walking around the expo with Larry Bushy from Going Linux podcast, interviewed last episode, he kept asking people about what other OSs the software would run on, things like that. And at first I thought he was just doing it to kind of get a reaction out of the people. But actually I realized as we continued to walk that he was asking because he was concerned about what he would be able to tell people coming to Linux in terms of interoperability. And I realized that that actually is quite important. I like to snub interoperability and think, well, Linux is good enough for me and it should be good enough for everyone. That's kind of like how I like to feel, at least at home, although I have to say once I get home, or once I get to work, and you know, a certain video codec won't work with one machine, but it will work on another machine of another OS, I sit there and, you know, get enraged. So it's kind of, it's a double standard that I have and like having, but in the real world, you can't really be that way, and there is a concern about the interoperability. So it was good to see open source being represented at scale, not just for Linux, but for other platforms. There were a couple of different, you know, extracurricular activities. I mean, there were the Birds of the Feather meetings, which were held in the evening upstairs in the different conference rooms. Those were all neat, and I certainly would have liked to go to different, you know, a couple of different ones, but you can only be so many places at once, so lots of different ones to go to, and I'm sure they were all very interesting. There was a good representation of people interested in the educational side, you know, using Linux in educational environments, which I think is just so great. There was a little email garden downstairs. There was a try-it-out lab where different projects had different demos of their software or their OS or whatever, or their distro rather, on a computer, and people could come in and try it out. So that was kind of neat. I didn't actually go into that because I didn't have that much time, and I think I had probably tried a lot of the stuff out that was there. Silicon Mechanics, which you'll probably see their ads a lot in Linux Journal and Linux Magazine, things like that, they were there, and they were giving away a server, which would have been great to win, but I didn't win it. Linux Magazine itself was there, which was nice. They had some back issues that they were giving away, and of course promoting new issues and subscriptions. And Linux Magazine is also always fun because they come with a DVD, so they're neat. I think it's called Linux Pro in Europe, or vice versa. It's one of those two things. And there was also the Free Software Foundation, the FSF.org, and they were really, really well represented. I know that they're pretty controversial in themselves, especially because of Richard Stallman and some of the things that he says, but I have to say, like, I think probably most Linux users at least recognize the importance, or the historical importance at the very least, of the FSF. I happen to think that they have very, very, a great deal of importance right now, but however you feel about them, I'm sure that you realize that you're using a lot of GNU tools every time you turn on your Linux box, so I'm sure you have some amount of respect for them. Now, if you have a lot of respect for them, you can certainly stop by their website, fsf.org, and become a member, and they'll send you, I think, a little USB key with a privacy suite, or you can get a book. And the people at the FSF booth were just really, really cool, very well articulated, and I brought a couple of my friends around to their booth just to kind of... I figured that someone behind, you know, a booth giving away free stickers would come across more convincing than just me talking to a friend about esoteric matters that I can't really even express probably that well. So they did a really good job of giving a very reasonable kind of sales pitch of how important FSF was. And it really, you know, they got them on all the good places, like the DRM and Bad Vista and all these other campaigns that they've got going on, that kind of the typical user can really, really understand, because that's the kind of stuff that they really use every day and can kind of see, yes, that's a problem. So I, you know, the FSF, it was really great that they were there, because they really did. I think they really got a great message across. And that's important, because I might be able to sell Linux up to the point of it being really fun to use, or really, really being cool and not, you know, being open source, but can you really sell it as like either an ideal or something to use even in the face of not being able to use, you know, such and such a program? That's where it starts to get hard, and I think sometimes it almost has to become an idealistic concern, because if you're going to forsake, you know, that one application that you like, whether it's, you know, Microsoft Office because you're like a power Office user, or whether it's GarageBand or iMovie or QuickBooks or whatever it is, that there's just no equivalent, it's hard to sell Linux at that point, because that becomes the deal breaker. The person says, well, if I can't have that, then as cool as Linux sounds and as cool as it looks on your computer and as much as you seem to love it, it's obviously not going to work for me, because I can't use this application on it. But with the FSF being able to express themselves to the point that it becomes an obvious and a reasonable idealistic concern, then I think that really, that helps people kind of decide that maybe either they can dual boot, or maybe that one application just isn't actually that important. Okay, I think that's the end of this show. It's been Season 2, Episode 10. It's been fun, and Scale was fun, and if you are either a new Linux user or you're not a new Linux user, and you think that you would like to meet other Linux users, you can certainly check out whatever local expo you can possibly hear about in your area, will try to make it out to California for scale next year. It's well worth it, trust me. It's just a lot of fun. It's a proper mixed bag of people. You never really know what one person is going to be like. You know, it's there's not really a stereotypical Linux user quite as much as you might think. They're really from just all over the place, all kinds of different people, and it's very motivating and very enlightening and very exciting to see that much Linux all in one place. This has been The Bad Apples, Episode 10, Season 2. If you need to contact me, it's gort.klaatu@gmail.com. That is gort.klaatu@gmail.com. You can also visit the website, thebadapples.info. That is thebadapples.info. The music for this podcast, as always, is done by the mysterious, the legendary, the ever-elusive Fat Chance Lester.